Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. First to the music we just started this segment with brought back memories. This might also ring some bells.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Soap operas have been part of the U.S. culture and entertainment landscape for decades, first appearing on the radio, then making the transition to the newfangled medium, television. They blaze trails in how stories were told and by whom, and their style has influenced how programs are shaped not only on network and cable TV, but on streaming services like Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon. Elena Levine is a professor and director of graduate studies and the Media Studies MA in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at the UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of a forthcoming book about daytime soaps and their influence on American culture. Elena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, take us to the primordial days of the soap opera. How did they get started?
Well, soap operas began in radio. They're one of the earliest narrative entertainment genres in American broadcasting. They started really in the early 1930s as a form of continuing story on daytime radio, where episodes would continue from day to day, usually just 15 minutes long each day. And they were sponsored by soap advertisers, laundry soap, dish soap, that sort of thing, who were trying to reach housewives and advertise their products to them. And so they would have an advertising message, they would tell the story, and then have the advertising message again before the show was over. So that's partly how they got their name and how the genre got established.
Now, it's one thing to make a commitment to listen to something in the background every day. Was it an easy sell to bring these soap operas from radio to TV, where you had to sit and watch it each and every day to keep up?
No, it was a very difficult sell, actually. Most of the sponsors, companies like Procter & Gamble that owned these shows and that were paying for them to appear on radio, were really reluctant for exactly the reasons you say. They thought that women were not going to stop their housework and stare at the screen. Of course, the screens were very small in those days, and people believed when television started that you had to really concentrate to see the images and understand them. And so it took a while, and actually one of the creators of soap operas in radio, a woman named Erna Phillips, who actually has a Wisconsin connection. She spent some time at UW-Madison. She decided to pay for an experimental episode of one of the shows she'd created as a television episode. It was airing on radio, and she wanted to prove to Procter & Gamble that the show could work on TV. And so she did. She paid for making an experimental TV episode, and they decided to give it a try. And so that helped to convince some of those sponsors to start putting these shows on TV. And it turned out audiences did want to watch and were more than happy to take a pause in their day and watch the television.
As I understand it, soap operas have generally been marketed toward women over the years. But were women prominent, as in that example you just gave, were women prominent behind the scenes as well?
Yes, absolutely. Soap operas are one of a really interesting genre of American broadcasting because women have always been so prominent in their creation. Erna Phillips, as I mentioned, is often considered the mother creator of the genre, and she was made many shows for radio and then transitioned and made many other shows for television, like As the World Turns and The Guiding Light. And she had protégés that she trained, some of whom were women, who went on to create their own programs. And of course, there's certainly lots of men in this history as well, but definitely on the creative side, there have been many prominent women.
Now, because this was a genre associated with women viewers, and as you say, women creators, you know, there's been a lot of parodies of soap operas. I think people have looked down on them in some ways as a form of entertainment. Is that, do you think, because it was viewed as women's entertainment in some way?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we live in a culture, especially historically, where things that women were invested in and cared about were often denigrated and seen as kind of less than things that were more respected and respectable. Part of it was also, I think, how explicitly commercial they were, how they were so clearly initially about selling soap, that they were designed to draw people in so that they could be subject to the commercial messages. Now, that was really true of almost all of broadcasting, other than public broadcasting from the early days. But soap operas and their associations with women got some of that kind of negative heat and dismissiveness. Part of it also, I think, is because the storytelling was very could tend to be sort of melodramatic, where you had, you know, very improbable things happening. But that was really one strand of storytelling in the genre, even in the radio days, that didn't apply to all of the programs. And by television, by the time television came along, the genre became much more realist and not as kind of melodramatic, at least for a number of years.
Talking to Elena Levine from UW-Milwaukee, looking at soap operas, their history and their influence on American culture. I got to say, Elena, I did watch soap operas for a while in my youth, General Hospital mostly. Didn't think much of them. When I started working in broadcasting, I went back and thought, what a huge logistical challenge to write, produce, act out these dramas that aired for an hour every day. This is a huge challenge.
Absolutely. It's kind of one of the most amazing production feats of the broadcast industry, if you really think about it. And, you know, in the early days, 15 minutes a day on radio, that was relatively manageable because you had actors standing around a microphone, although there were scripts being written for every day. But in television, starts 15 minutes, expands pretty quickly to half hour, and then, as you say, becomes hour-long episodes, which happened in the 1970s. And, you know, there's still a number of these shows on air today, and they're producing an hour episode every day. It's quite amazing.
We're jumping past some history, but, you know, there was a heyday, it seemed like, in the 70s and 80s. And then there was a big shakeup, it seemed like, where soaps were threatened. Some were canceled. Talk us through the fall and maybe rise again of some soap operas.
Sure. Yes, you're right. So the soaps really increase in their kind of power and their popularity and their kind of economic significance for the broadcast industry throughout the 60s, 70s, and most of the 80s. But then, as was true of most of broadcast network television, the ratings start to go down a bit. Advertisers are less willing to spend as much money to advertise their programs, and the audience starts to fall away. Now, there's lots of factors that contribute to this. Certainly, the rise of cable is really important initially, as audiences have more choices of what they can watch. And then, of course, a little bit later, the internet comes along and multiplies our choices even further. So there's those factors that play a part. Some people talk about women being more frequently in the workplace and not being home during the day to watch. I'm a little dubious about that claim because there were women watching these shows who were working in the 60s and 70s and 80s as well, using things like VCRs initially and then DVRs to time shift and keeping up other ways, watching on TV at work. So I'm not sure that women in the workplace is the main shift. I think it's more a kind of explosion of viewing options that people have had that have taken them away from that kind of daily habit. But yeah, the programs have, you know, were declining in popularity and in how much money they were making across the later 80s and the 90s and the 2000s. And then in the later 2000s, some of the broadcast networks started to realize that they weren't profiting at all from these programs anymore, and a number of long-running daytime soap operas were canceled. And then as of about 2012, there were only four such programs still on air, and that's still the situation we're in today.
Are those shows that are still on doing better now? Is there a resurgence, a renaissance?
I think in some ways there is. It's certainly nowhere near the heights that it was at in the early 80s, for example, when they were incredibly popular. But they're kind of maintaining. Their budgets have been cut, so they're producing shows at a much lower budget than they once were. And they have a number of really kind of inventive ways, I think, in which the creators have come up with to do that. But the budgets have been cut. But they are still making some money. Some of the programs are profitable because they are also sold internationally. And so they are doing okay in the U.S., but they're incredibly popular. There's a show, The Bold and the Beautiful, which is on CBS, which is incredibly popular internationally, gets, you know, big ratings in Europe. And so there's other ways in which these shows are finding to kind of keep afloat.
We're talking to Elena Levine right now, professor in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about soap operas in American culture, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a fan of soap operas? What is it about the stories and characters that kept or keep you watching day after day, year after year? Do you feel that those stories and formats are still relevant today? Or do you have a question for our guest about the history of soap operas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Professor Elena Levine of UW-Milwaukee about the influence of soap operas on our culture and in how TV stories are told. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you a fan of soap operas? Do you think they've influenced American culture and entertainment? Do they deserve more respect than they're given sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Valerie is with us in Muscadet. Valerie, hi.
Hi. Great topic. Thank you. I just wanted to say I'm 60, and I off and on, starting in college in the late 70s, started watching all my children. Back then it was a communal event. People would watch in the dorm on the communal floor where there would be one TV. And then, you know, I graduated, started working, and didn't watch it for a while. Then VCRs came out, just like your guest said, started taping it. And then also I'm a working artist, and there have been periods in my life when I've been able to paint full-time. And I would plan my painting day around my lunch break where I could get out of the studio and eat my soup and watch all my children. And I was just, you know, pretty crushed when it went away. It disrupted my whole daily routine. And then one more comment is that as far as social relevance, I can still to this day remember how amazing it was when it turned out that they were going to make Erica Kane's daughter, Bianca, be a lesbian.
Valerie, thank you so much for sharing that. A lot of ways we could go with that. Let's start with that connection or disconnect, maybe at different points, to social issues, Elena.
Yeah, well, All My Children is the best example of that, really. That and One Life to Live, which were two shows created by a woman named Agnes Nixon, who just passed away last year, who was a great innovator in this genre because she introduced these social issues to daytime soap opera storytelling in a way that people hadn't really seen previously. And so the example of Erica Kane's daughter, Bianca, coming out as a lesbian is a more recent example of the kinds of issues they did, but they were doing that kind of thing in 1971. That character, Erica Kane, actually had a legal abortion on television, arguably the first character to have a legal abortion on television. This was before Roe versus Wade, where abortion law varied by state. And so they tells a really fascinating story about the character's efforts to get an abortion at that time. And there's many other examples like that, stories about drug abuse, stories about racism, stories about the Vietnam War. All of these things were being dealt with on these shows in large part in that period in the late 60s and in the 1970s, but then that came back again in the 90s and 2000s with examples like Valerie was talking about.
Valerie, thanks for the call. Sorry you lost your show. We'll go next to Steve in Montreal. Steve, hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
What'd you want to tell us about, Steve?
Okay, hey. I was down on the Ohio River seeing my grandmother, and she was proceeded to curse this character who was on General Hospital. And I know she watched General Hospital. And then she looked at me and she said, "Stevie, I'm okay. It's just a soap opera."
Thank you so much, Steve, for sharing that story about your grandma. Yeah, people... people felt strongly about the characters, and there's definitely the characters people loved to hate and even curse at. Elena.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, part of it is just seeing these people every day in your home where you usually would be watching this. And you really get to know the characters well. I mean, think about our relationships to characters in programs that don't air that frequently, you know, like on Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones or something like that. And that gets even more intensified on a daytime soap because you spend so much time with them. So that kind of reaction is really common.
And you mentioned, thanks a lot for that call, Steve, you mentioned things like Breaking Bad and so on. And it seemed like there's this gradual change in primetime TV where, okay, maybe they didn't become soap operas, but shows were willing to have narratives that you had to follow from one episode to the next. And it was this huge new innovative thing for a lot of TV, but soaps had been doing it forever.
Exactly. And there's been, you know, periods off and on throughout primetime television history where they've told those kinds of continuing stories, which are so typical now of a lot of the TV we watch. But in, you know, the 80s, that started with what were called the primetime soaps like Dallas and Dynasty and those kinds of shows. And then those died out and there would be, you know, a spattering of shows that were doing this kind of thing. But now we're definitely in an era of really deep investment in these continuing narratives, which differ from daytime soaps in many ways, but also are borrowing from a fundamental storytelling form that the soaps are really the ones that invented.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Josiah is with us, and Nina, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what exactly a soap opera is.
Oh, that's a great basic question. Yeah, they aren't as prominent as they once were. And also it can be hard, Elena, sometimes to pin down the border between soap opera and something kind of like a soap opera.
Exactly. Well, and I think that maybe the borders aren't as firm as we might imagine them to be. So usually, as I was saying earlier, the name came originally from the sponsors of these programs, which were soap companies selling dish soap and laundry soap and that kind of thing. And the opera part of it was meant to be a little bit disparaging originally, saying, oh, look how overly dramatic these programs are, as if they're something like an opera. But in fact, they're just trying to sell soap. So that was originally a very disparaging label. But over the years, the industry and the audience just sort of accepted it and said, okay, we're going to just call them that from now on. But some of the features that mark the genre, at least in its daytime form, are continuing stories that continue from episode to episode. There's no ending. The story just goes on every episode. They usually have a community of characters, a pretty large cast and multiple storylines going on at once. Often the stories deal with personal life in some way, romances, family drama and family dynamics. Some soaps have introduced other kinds of plots, like crime stories, mafia plots. There were brief periods in soap history that had more science fiction kinds of elements to them. So we've kind of seen it all. There's sort of no limit to what the stories are about. What defines them more is their daily airing and their continuing storytelling.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Elena Levine from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the past, present, and maybe future of the TV soap opera. Back to your calls now. Greg is with us in Oshkosh. Greg, hi.
Hi. Thank you. This is a fascinating topic.
Thanks.
I have an anecdote. I'm a little bit older than the time period you're talking about. I'm also 60, as one of the earlier callers was. But I remember with my friends playing in the summertime, doing outdoor activities, boy-type activities, baseball, football, camping, things like that. But we would all get together in the afternoon and watch Dark Shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason we were allowed to do that and felt like we could do that was because there were vampires.
Yep.
Greg, thank you so much for sharing that story. And yeah, Elena, Dark Shadows kind of started as a more normal soap. Do I have this right? And then vampires kind of segued in over time?
Yeah, it always was a little bit offbeat. It had a kind of gothic feel to it. It wasn't set in a sort of familiar, everyday American household like most of the soaps were. But within its first year on air, they decided they needed to do something to kind of make it a little more exciting and started to introduce these supernatural plots. And what hit really big was this vampire character named Barnabas Collins. And the audience went crazy for it, especially kids and young people in general who were, you know, watching the program often in the late afternoons after school or in the summer. And, you know, were just kind of amazed that this crazy stuff was going on TV.
Thanks, Greg, for sharing that story. We'll go next to Jean with us in Richland Center. Jean, hi.
Hi.
Would you want to tell us about Jean?
I never got into the programs very much, but my mother lived with them for 15 minutes a day.
Dad
come home from work one day, and she was crying, and he said, "What in the world's the matter?" She said, "Penny died." And he said, "Who in the world is Penny?" She's on as the world turns. And he said, "Oh, good grief."
Jean, thank you so much. I'm guessing, Atlanta, there are a lot of stories like that. And okay, we can say, oh, it's kind of cheaply produced and, you know, the writing isn't always the greatest. But clearly, over time, people felt connections here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, probably the deepest, most, you know, heartfelt connections that you hear when people talk about their memories of, you know, consuming media are these stories from soap opera, just like that. And that, you know, it was really powerful to see a character that you knew their family, you knew so much about what had happened to them, and seeing them go through difficult times or die or things like that. Yeah, there's many, many stories like that. It's great to hear, you know, everyone has their own individual story, but together it becomes a sort of broader cultural phenomenon.
Thanks a lot for that call. Very briefly, just a few moments left, Elena. Are we seeing new things coming along on Netflix or YouTube? Is somebody using high technology to take the place of soaps?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a kind of new little independent genre of what are sometimes called web soaps that initially began just airing on websites or on YouTube and have been picked up by streaming services like Amazon and Netflix. And these are shows often that have creators behind them who are people who had been involved with the broadcast television soaps, either actors or actresses who are wanting to try a new project or writers trying something new now that the broadcast industry has gotten smaller. And so there's this kind of interesting space where you see some potential for maybe this is going to turn into a new phenomenon in a new form as our ways of watching television evolve.
Elena, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Elena Levine is professor and director of graduate studies and the media studies MA in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at the UW-Milwaukee. She specializes in, among other things, daytime dramas, soap operas in American culture. You can still share your stories and memories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.